voice was flat calm. Jamie felt a surge of pressure pushing him against the chair's back. Nothing startling. He had driven sports cars with more acceleration. The picture of Earth on the display screen did not change discernibly. But Vosnesensky's voice said,
"We are off, on schedule. Mars 2 thruster ignition was precisely on time also."
A clearly American voice broke in.
"We're off for Mars!"
Not one of the scientists cheered. Jamie wanted to, but felt too embarrassed. An image of Edith formed in his mind, the strangely sad smile on her pretty face as they said goodbye for the final time. No, not the final time, Jamie told himself. I'll be back. I'll see her when I get back. He did not notice Tony Reed staring at him, thinking, I got rid of that prick Hoffman, and neither our Navajo geologist nor pretty Joanna has even so much as thanked me for it. Perhaps I made a mistake. She's interested in this Red Indian. As long as he's among us, Joanna won't even look at me. Sol 3. Night. They did not eat together that night. Joanna and the other two women huddled by the biology bench, ignoring food as they tested the green-streaked rock. Tony Reed and a couple of the other men drifted by, but the women shooed them away. Jamie picked at his meal, worrying more about the idiotic news media back home than the Martian rock. It's copper, he told himself. Got to be. But suppose it isn't. A part of his mind wanted the rock to be life-bearing. In fact, as he sat alone at the wardroom table, methodically working his way through the bland microwave meal, Jamie realized that if they had indeed found life, it would surely divert the media's attention from this Native American business. He got up and took his half-finished tray to the recycler, scraped the food into the slot in its top, and then stacked the tray and his utensils in the dishwasher's rack. Someone had put a swing-era tape on the sound system. A clarinet sweet as licorice worked through an old ballad. Laughter rose from the far side of the dome, men joking together. He recognized Patel's high-pitched squeal. His fellow geologist had found something amusing. Whom was he sharing it with? Reed? Naguib? Toshima? From the sound of it, they were all in one of the lab areas together. Vosnesensky and the three other pilots were sitting around one of the communications consoles. Its screen showed a topographical map. Planning the first cross-country traverse, Jamie thought as he walked past them.
Waterman, come and look at this, called Vosnesensky. Latest photos of the Badlands.
Jamie joined them and saw that the image on the screen was a map of contour lines superimposed on a photograph of the Noctis Labyrinthus region, slightly less than 300 kilometers to the south. He pulled a chair from the monitoring station next to the comm console and joined the little group. Noctis Labyrinthus, the Badlands, a real labyrinth of interconnected canyons and chains of craters, fault lines that ran for hundreds of kilometers like giant cracks crisscrossing the ground, slumped canyon walls with landslides that may have been caused by flowing water. The labyrinth was at the western end of the titanic Valles Marineris, the Grand Canyon of Mars, that extended more than 4,000 kilometers, at places so wide that an observer standing on the lip of the 7-kilometer-deep canyon could not see the other side of it. Named after the Mariner 9 spacecraft that discovered the giant rift, Valles Marineris was longer than North America was wide, and deeper than the Atlantic Ocean. Its western end butted into the enormous upswelling of a Tharsis bulge, where 10-kilometer-high volcanoes sat atop a mammoth blister of rock the size of Europe. Where the deeply carved Valles Marineris meets the dense rock of the Tharsis Bulge, the Badlands of the Noctis Labyrinthus spreads its fractured pattern of canyons. From orbit above Mars, it almost looks as if the great rip in the ground was stopped and shattered by the uplifted bulge, the way a battering ram might splinter against an iron door.
We are deciding on the route for the first traverse, Vosnesensky said as Jamie sat down in front of the display screen.
Jamie looked at the four flyers. Vosnesensky seemed brooding and melancholy, as usual. Mironov was smiling the way a man does when he is bored or embarrassed. Connors was studying the map display intently, as if trying to memorize it. Paul Abel had a puzzled, quizzical expression on his pop-eyed face. Tapping a fingernail against the screen, Jamie said,
I'd like to arrive here, at this point.
Abel said, "That's not exactly where Father DiNardo indicated in his mission plan, is it?"
"Not quite. I've been thinking about this traverse all during our flight here. This spot here is a branching point. I can look at three canyons from there."
Leaning forward enough to reach the keyboard, Jamie punched up an enlargement of the region. "You see? There's slumping here, a landslide, and clear fracture lines."
"Yes, yes," said Voznesensky impatiently. "That is permissible. We can get you to that point."
"Good.
I have decided to drive the rover myself," Voznesensky said.
Jamie glanced at Connors. The American did not seem surprised. Jamie realized that he had been keeping his eyes focused on the display screen because he was angry. The astronaut's lips were pressed together in a grim, tight line.
"I thought the mission plan called for Pete to drive the rover."
"I have changed the plan," Voznesensky said flatly.
"Why?"
"This is no reflection on Pete. He will still command one of the other traverses and fly the soar plane."
"But why change the mission plan?" Jamie insisted.
Mironov's smile had gradually dwindled. He said,
"This has nothing to do with politics, I assure you."
Which immediately made Jamie think that it was entirely due to national pride and competition, or at least some form of rivalry between the Russians and the Americans. Connors finally spoke up.
"It's cool, Jamie. We talked it over. Mike just wants to take the first traverse himself."
Forcing a humorless grin, the astronaut added,
"It's part of Mike's god complex. He's afraid something will go wrong if he's not there running the show himself."
Mikhail Voznesensky made himself smile back at Connors.
"I have no intention of flying the soar plane. You may have that honor entirely to yourself."
Connors nodded and turned back toward the display screen. Jamie asked,
"Do we start the traverse as scheduled?"
"In 2 days, yes."
"The only change," Mironov said, "is to substitute Mikhail Andreevich as your chauffeur."
"Does Dr. Lee know about this?" Jamie asked.
"He will be informed. I do not expect him to object," Voznesensky said.
With a shrug, Jamie said,
"Well, I guess it's okay then."
Mironov got to his feet, and Voznesensky lumbered up from his chair a fraction of a second after him. For a wild moment, Jamie got the impression that Mironov was in charge, not Voznesensky. Vaguely, he recalled that the Russians used to have political officers among the men who worked at subsidiary jobs, but were actually the real bosses. As the two Russians walked away, Connors said earnestly,
"Listen, Jamie, the last thing I want is for a Soviet-American rivalry to break out here."
"But why'd he do it?" Jamie asked. Leaning his forearms on his knees, Connors answered,
"I think he really has a god complex. He thinks that if he's in charge, nothing will go wrong. It's the first overland traverse, and he's nervous about it."
Abel looked skeptical, but said nothing.
"You don't mind being bumped?" Jamie asked.
Connors leaned back again, away from him.
"Sure I mind. Shit, who wouldn't mind? But like the man said, there'll be other traverses. Let him take the first one.
It's okay. I'll do the soar plane flying. You can't talk me out of that." Abel grunted.
"So our friend Mike gets to play God, but he lets you be the angel."
Connors tapped Abel on the shoulder and got up from his chair. Abel left with him. Jamie sat alone in front of the display screen, caring less about who drove the damned rover than he did about what they would find when they reached the intersection of those three canyons. Finally, he flicked the display off and got to his feet. Scanning the dome's interior, he saw that the women were still at the biology bench, but they were talking among themselves now, no longer bent over the equipment. The music had ended. The dome was quiet. Joanna looked tired. Jamie approached them slowly, but they did not seem to notice him. They sat in the spindly Martian gravity chairs, earnestly talking among themselves.
"How's it going?"
Turning in her chair, Ilona gave him a bitter scowl.
"It's inorganic."
"You were right," said Joanna. "It is nothing more than oxidized copper."
Even the normally cheerful Monique seemed downcast.
"No organic material at all, neither in the rock itself nor in the soil samples. No long-chain molecules."
Jamie stood evenly balanced on the balls of his feet, as if ready to fight or flee, depending on the circumstances. "They can give me the rock now, so I can determine its age and how long it's been sitting on the surface."
"But there's water."